It's becoming very difficult to see that our glass is half full when so many of our reservoirs are nearly empty. So we ask, is our weird weather a consequence of nature or nurture?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Welcome to the 1,333rd edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in Elfin Cove who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, it used to be that our reservoirs out west held water. But if you were to look around today, you would see that now they are mostly holding air. At least, that is what I saw on a recent road trip up I-5 through California's Central Valley into Oregon, which took me past the Great Shasta Reservoir, which feeds California's Sacramento River with cold water through the heat of the state's hot summers. When I looked down to the bottom of that barren brown lake basin, I saw a bare trickle of water. Frightening! Shasta is not the only dam out here in the West that is holding mostly air. Most all of them are. And surface water dams are not the only reservoirs that are running low on water. The state's aquifers are really having a tough time of it as well. Two of the most important aquifers in the United States are those of California's Central Valley and the Oglala beneath the Great Plains of the Heartland. Both are in arid regions where more than half of America's food is grown. And when more water is withdrawn from an aquifer than is deposited, the ground subsides beneath our feet. The West is shriveling up like a plum drying into a prune. Some say the weird weather is simply Mother Nature having her way and point to tree rings to tell the story of droughts coming and going throughout time. Others say the weird weather is being nurtured by them and point to a sky filled with wild patterns of vapor trails. I, for one, have leaned toward the nature side of the debate, but when I saw video of a bone-dry Yangtze River not flowing through downtown Shanghai during the peak of China's flood season, I thought, maybe it's time to consider that weather is being nurtured. Here to help us explore that possibility, we have Dane Wigington, who is a lead researcher at Geoengineering Watch and host of GeoWatch Radio. Dane, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you very much for all the years you spent trying to sound the alarm on the state of the environment. I'm certainly with you on that. No functional habitat, no humans, very simple. And we have definitely trashed the planet in too many ways to even begin to quantify. But that being said, 20 years ago, after doing extensive study on anthropogenic damage to the planet, human-caused damage, having the IPCC manuals here, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that's the largest scientific panel on any subject in human history. But I moved to a large off-grid home in Northern California, solar, wind, and hydro, and I began to lose massive amounts of my solar uptake from whatever these aircraft were emitting. I have a background in the industry. I work for Bechtel Power, largest engineering firm in the world. I knew that could not be condensation, began to test my precipitation, and found what I didn't want to find, climate engineering elements.
And there we go. So I guess if I were to ask you, nature or nurture, you would say?
Well, again, every form of human activity that affects the energy balance of the planet and the planet's life support systems is certainly a problem. But that being said, there can be no legitimate discussion about the climate from any perspective without addressing this biggest of all single part of the puzzle, not outweighing necessarily all other parts, but this intentional intervention in the planet's life support systems is virtually derailing all of Earth's life support systems. And again, we're not speculating. We have film footage of these aircraft at altitude, nozzles visible, turning dispersions on and off, elements named in climate engineering patents like aluminum, barium, strontium, manganese, polymer fibers, graphene, all showing up in our precipitation tests. Mm-hmm. And we took a National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration flying lab at great effort and expense to altitude with top scientists in it, sampled what heavy aircraft were emitting in our skies, processed it, the samples at one of the world's most renowned labs and found exactly what we knew we would find, climate engineering elements.
Well, that's certainly an experiment that you conducted that we want to pick up down the road here a little bit. But I'd like to back up a little bit, Dane, and ask you, when was it that that apple fell on your head that woke you up to the possibility that somebody really is engineering the sky to fall?
When I began to lose, on Sundays, 60-70% of my solar power uptake or more. And this is, my home was on the cover of the world's largest renewable energy magazine. It's a big solar system. I mean, it's a state-of-the-art solar system, and losing that much power from whatever these aircraft were emitting, not a natural cloud in the sky, I knew that that could not be condensation. And I was really taken back that I had not heard at that point, this was 20 years ago, or was not yet aware of the massive amount of data on geoengineering, climate engineering, solar radiation management, stratospheric aerosol injection. Those are the science terms for the attempt by the powers that be, governments around the globe, to mitigate global warming by spraying light scattering particles into the sky. So my massive loss of solar power uptake, Mike, was that was my alarm bell going off, and it's been a battle ever since, 20 years nonstop.
So you were just up in the mountains. You built this wonderful solar array to collect sunlight and power your world up there, and then you noticed a decided decline in the power that you were getting. Now, could not that have been a decaying photovoltaic cells or something like that, a mechanical problem?
Not when the system is brand new and state-of-the-art. And it's not just my system. You have some of the largest commercial PV photovoltaic facilities in the country that have produced about half their design capacity, and they don't know why, because they won't acknowledge this massive elephant in the sky. And I want to stress to your listeners, when you lose half your solar power, it doesn't mean that half the light is blocked. It means half the direct sunlight is blocked. Solar panels don't work unless they have direct, unobstructed sunlight. When you put light scattering particles in the sky, you completely disrupt that process. And paradoxically, climate engineering is not just disrupting solar power, it's radically hampering the other two primary forms of alternative energy, wind and hydro. When you fill the sky with light scattering particles, you affect convection, therefore you affect wind, therefore you diminish wind power. We have what's called wind droughts now in many of the regions with wind farms, and you radically affect hydropower. These particles disrupt the evaporative cycle, thus they disrupt the hydrological cycle. And you have hydro dams all over the world that can't produce anything.
You know, Dane, when I came out with my book, Metro Farm, which essentially says that you don't need a big farm to make a profitable living. You can do it with a small farm in or near the city. Well, I was met with a lot of skepticism. As a matter of fact, I was kind of almost run out of the country for being a heretic by conventional agriculture. And the reason is really quite simple, because they don't want anybody competing with them in the marketplace. They want people to go in the grocery store and spend $5 on 10 cents worth of corn in a box and think they're doing good. So they really do not want people to compete with them. So I understand why they looked at me as a heretic. Why are they looking at you as a heretic?
Well, again, those who are ultimately behind this climate engineering Manhattan Project, and that's certainly what it is, want to mask this, of course, from populations for as long as possible. If populations understood that they'd all been exposed to a grand and lethal experiment without their knowledge or their consent, an experiment with no environmental impact consideration whatsoever, there would certainly be a shockwave around the globe. And these operations have allowed the powers that be to mask the true severity of damage that's been done to the planet, while at the same time inflicting even more damage, Mike, just much like the pharmaceutical commercials we see, that they broadcast a new product that treats a certain symptom and you hear the downstream side effects and you wonder who would take that product, it's the same mentality. So they're using, in essence, weather as a weapon to keep business as usual, to create, and this is one aspect of climate engineering we can cover when you want to get there, massive engineered cool downs with chemical ice nucleating elements, much like you see on the snow slope or the ski slope, where the slope is covered with snow and the rest of the mountain's bare. Same elements sprayed into cloud moisture. But they can create division in the population as to the two-state of climate damage, and thus keep the debate going and keep business as usual going while using weather as a weapon in countries all over the world without those countries ever even knowing they are under assault.
Let's go way back to the start. When did we start re-engineering climate?
We know climate engineering operations known as geoengineering, which is the scale that they are on, meaning global, and that started in earnest immediately after World War II. We know they were beta testing during World War II. Mike, you've seen the B-17 bombers that leave the massive dispersions behind them, and people refer to that as proof that this is all just condensation. You've seen those films. And
right.
So we found in the military archives, and that's, in fact, the footage we found is posted on our groundbreaking documentary titled The Dimming at geoengineeringwatch.org. You can view for free. But we found military archives of what appears to be beta testing. It was film taken from one B-17 of another. They're flying in formation directly above, leaving a massive dispersion that is cut instantaneously in air as if it was cut with a knife. That can only be a dispersion. That's not condensation. They didn't kill all four of their engines and magically fly along without them. So we knew they were beta testing. They deployed after World War II. We have Project Cirrus, the start of hurricane modification that started in 1947. And what's very telling, I would encourage your listeners, our weekly non-commercial, non-political broadcast, Global Alert News at geoengineeringwatch.org, at the very beginning, first 30 seconds, we show film footage, President Lyndon Baines Johnson ranting like a lunatic, stating at that time in 1962, he was vice president then, we had the power to control the world's cloud layer then, and he who controls the weather controls the world. The history is absolutely inarguable, and that's the tip of the iceberg.
Right there. And I did watch The Dimming this morning, and I did see that piece, and it was a wake-up, I guess, when it gets right down to it. When they're telling you they can control the world, you have to listen to what they're saying. We're going to take a break here in just a minute or so, but when we come back from that break, I'd like to talk with you about how they go about managing the climate or changing the climate or doing whatever they're engineering the climate. And one of the ways, of course, is by dispersing aerosols via aircraft, high-flying aircraft. And you've done a lot of work with this principle and can really fill us in on it. And one of the curious things is that when I've talked with other people about the air, what we see in the sky, and, you know, when we look up in the sky and we see these contrails from high-flying aircraft, there seem to be two kinds of contrails that we see. One is a light tail, as it were, of white vapor that flows in back of the plane. It's like being towed on a string, and it just kind of evaporates as the airplane progresses across the sky. But the other kind is kind of like these long, white, grayish trains that will lag behind an airplane, and then just kind of flatten out and spread out to form a thin cloud. And I'm wondering if there are two different things, or maybe I'm just hallucinating. Well, that's where we're going to go with Dane Wigington when we come back. Is it nature or is it nurture? What do you think? This is the Food Chain Radio program. Do stay tuned.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson with Dane Wigington. Dane, those little white clouds that float behind airplanes high in the sky, what is causing them?
That's core to this whole issue, Michael. And the condensation trail narrative is an immense deception that has been perpetrated on populations around the world.
What is it? They say that the condensation is just water vapor coming out of the engine.
Let's examine that narrative if we can. Is it possible that a jet engine can produce a condensation trail? Of course. But what we have on all commercial carriers and all military tankers is a modern high-bypass turbofan jet engine. It's a jet-powered fan. 90% of the air that moves through that engine is not combusted. Very different than a turbofan jet engine or a low-bypass turbofan jet engine. So we know that engine is nearly incapable of making any condensation trail except under rare and extreme circumstances, and even then it would be very short-lived. People should ask themselves, how does condensation behave? When we see a documentary in Antarctica and we see a researcher that has his breath condensing, is there a cloud hanging over his head for 15, 20 minutes if he's standing in one location? Or condensation doesn't do that. This is a particulate dispersion, and we know that because, again, we have film footage of these aircraft with nozzles visible turning on and off. We have up-close photographs of the retrofit nozzles, even on commercial aircraft, and we're not implicating commercial pilots or personnel, but their aircraft are being used. Certainly, we know that's the case because we have film footage of it. But retrofit nozzles mounted on the wing pylons aimed into the exhaust jet stream to make this look like condensation. And again, we have the same particles named in climate engineering patents showing up in the air column in every single precipitation test we take. We have, to go further, we have documents at geoengineeringwatch.org, some 700-800 pages long. One particular Senate document that outlines global cooperation with these programs between nations with, quote, otherwise adversarial relations, because you can't just geoengineer over your own country. You're familiar with the butterfly effect, of course, and there would have to be global cooperation. Indeed, there is. And if people understood the severity of damage done to the planet, if they understood the fact that the controllers know this, and they have, again, long since intervened in the climate system to try to keep business as usual, to mask the severity of damage done in order to retain their power, and that's how they keep business as usual. So, again, regarding this being condensation, the fact that we have up-close film footage of these aircraft at altitude turning on and off dispersions with nozzles visible, that's the end of the debate on that.
And, you know, those video of those aircraft doing that are available in your documentary, The Dimming. Now, some people say that the contrary of is true, that these high bypass turbofan engines produce much more water vapor than the older engines, and that is why you're seeing much more condensation and much more trails.
Let's examine that statement, though. These engines are designed solely for fuel efficiency. Again, let's look at the physics of the engine. 90% of the air that moves that engine is not combusted. Therefore, anyone that makes the argument that you just outlined, and I know they do, it's simply not backed up by science or the laws of physics. And I would ask people, again, to rely on their own sense of reason and observation. Film footage, nozzles visible, turning on and off, negates every other argument that this is just condensation.
Okay. Now, what are they putting in the fuel that would cause trouble in the environment?
Let's start with aluminum. Bioavailable aluminum is toxic to every single life form on this planet. And people make the argument, well, aluminum is an abundant element. It's a large percentage of the Earth's strata. We should expect to see it everywhere. That is not true. Aluminum does not exist in the environment in free form naturally, period. It is always bonded to other elements because it's highly reactive. If we find free-form aluminum in our precipitation, and we are, that means it's been mined and refined and dispersed, period. So what's that done to our soils here in Northern California? I have the USDA baselines, as I told you off air, in my possession, huge, huge manuals, all the original mapping down to the acre. And the pH values here in my forested location of Northern California have changed 10 to 12 times toward alkaline in recent decades. That's from the loading of these metals in the rain that's saturating soils, killing soil microbiome, affecting root systems. We have peer-reviewed study in the case of aluminum on root systems. They shut down nutrient uptake. They die a slow, protracted death. So we have the so-called experts telling us that it's just the beetles killing the trees. Beetles are simply a symptom of a sick and dying tree. So we add that metal to barium, strontium, manganese, polymer fibers. I'm sure, Michael, you've seen many articles lately about the polymer fibers that are showing up ubiquitously all over the planet, from North Pole, South Pole, top of Mount Everest, everywhere.
That's right.
And we know polymer fibers are a part of the climate engineering mix. And that's not to deny the plastic pollution and decomposition, not at all. But when we know it's a part of these operations, a part of the patents showing up in our precipitation testing, we certainly must include that in the mix as well. So it's a very lethal brew. All of these elements toxic by themselves, but when you combine them, there's a factor called synergistic toxicity. One example of that, we all have mercury in us from coal-fired power plants, amalgam fillings, other sources. When you combine mercury with aluminum, which we all have in us now too, the overall toxicity can increase, this is peer-reviewed study, by as much as 10,000%. That's hard to get your arms around. That's 100 times worse. So it's really a wonder any of us are still generally functional at this point, in my opinion.
Well, some of us are, at least. Some of us aren't. Depends on the time of day, I guess.
I understand your point, yeah.
Good. So, but why? Why would anybody put these things in our atmosphere?
You have to look at this, and this is in the terms of climate engineers. They consider this a risk-to-risk scenario, the risk of doing it versus the risk of not doing it. Now, and you have to look at that through their perspective, because this is not being done for the greater good. That needs to be clear. This is a weapon of war, and that translates into many different things. If those in power feel, and that includes very major interests like the carbon industry and so forth, in order to keep business as usual, they need to keep the controversy going, accelerating, about the true state of the climate. So that's a core aspect of climate engineering. When you can engineer cool downs, Michael, I think we talked about this off air too, that we talked about the massive cool down in Dallas, Texas a year and a half ago, whenever that was. There's no chance that any meteorologist that is remotely coherent doesn't know that that was not nature. You can't have water vapor off the record warm Gulf of Mexico create surface temperatures down to zero while temperatures at the same time at the approximate same latitude in Florida were 85 degrees. Temperatures at the North Pole were 33 degrees warmer at that window of time than Dallas, Texas. And chemical ice nucleation, when you seed clouds with it, and these are patented processes, I want to stress that. People can look at the extensive list of patents at geoengineeringwatch.org. But you create a very cold, dense layer of air that descends to the surface, much like when you go into a market and you see a giant open freezer, no top on it, but everything's frozen inside that basin because the cold air sits there. And that's exactly what they're doing. And we have chemical ice nucleating elements found in precipitation testing. We know they're doing this. I would encourage your listeners to search Chinese scientists create artificial snowstorm, because Fox News covered it, Popular Science covered it, ABC, NBC, CNN. They did, $2 billion worth of damage to Beijing, exact same processes. And then, of course, the public was enraged, and they realized that they can't publicize these sorts of operations, and now they don't. But masking the true severity of climate damage from the public to keep business as usual, primary aspect, and weather as a weapon. Right after 9/11, Michael, you might remember General Wesley Clark was given a list of Middle Eastern countries to be targeted. And that was a list that clearly existed before 9/11. Subsequently, every one of those countries underwent a once-in-1,000-year drought. Statistically, mathematically, that's impossible to have that kind of coincidence unless there's climate intervention involved, which is very effective at creating drought. We have the leaders of those countries, in the case of Iran, on the floor of the UN, stating emphatically NATO was cutting off their precipitation. Let's go back to what President Johnson said. He who controls the weather controls the world. So what happened in Iran? They destabilized food production, thus they destabilized populations, thus they destabilized the country. Much easier to control a country that way. He who controls the weather controls the weather world.
Okay, so you've made mention of many different things that they put in the fuel that they disperse via air, into our atmosphere, and you've kind of described why, though I still don't quite understand. Somebody asked me to ask you, if the government is re-engineering the climate and then making a mess of things, as you do when you're trying to do good and you have all of these good intentions and who knows where they go, but then things go bad. So now we have the government yelling at us for causing global warming by driving my old Jeep powered by gasoline. Do you think the government is using, or those in power are using this climate change argument to obscure what they're doing?
Again, I want to stress that this is not a this or that equation. It's all the above. Every form of human activity that's affecting the energy balance of the planet is a part of the problem. We've been very poor stewards of the planet. We've trashed it in the geologic blink of an eye. But that being said, the intentional intervention is the most disruptive factor of all. As far as governments making a mess of things, let's look at other activities of theirs. The detonation of 2,400 nuclear bombs, which has contaminated everything on the planet. Don't they know they work after maybe a few dozen? Project Starfish Prime. Many of your listeners might not know about this specific experiment of detonating hydrogen bombs in the magnetosphere, which is still causing, we're still feeling the reverberations of that damage today. They did it anyway. They had no idea what it would do, but they did it. So we have governments that don't consider the long-term consequences of their actions. We have leaders, so-called leaders, and that's not our elected officials. They are not in charge. I want to stress that. The whole political system, people should step back and ask themselves, who was the last president to truly draw a line in the sand? John F. Kennedy. Didn't live long afterward either. Those who print the money are in charge of the entire matrix. They control the strings. That should be clear by now, and they keep the debate going to keep the political divide going. But the bottom line is, this is about power and control, period, and a covert weapon with which they can control populations.
Okay, going back to how they can control the environment or how they can engineer the environment, they have these tools, one of which, of course, is dispersing elements into the environment. But can they control those elements somehow? Does HAARP have something to do with how they control them? How do they manage the climate or re-engineer the climate using these ingredients?
Very, very important question. Thank you for asking. For your listeners that don't know what HAARP is, it's an ionosphere heater. And that is an ominous term, and it should be. It's a weapon of mass destruction, ultimately. HAARP can transmit 3.5 million watts of power into the electrically charged ionosphere, causes an electrical chain reaction, superheats the ionosphere. That pushes the atmosphere up and down. The downward push creates a high-pressure heat dome. And we've heard that term constantly from meteorologists now, high-pressure heat domes that are blocking precipitation from certain regions. There's about 100 facilities like HAARP around the globe. HAARP is the most powerful, but there are many more. And with that, they can create high and low-pressure zones. In the northern hemisphere, a high-pressure zone spins upper-level winds clockwise around it. Low-pressure zone spins counterclockwise. By being able to create these pressure zones, they can steer upper-level winds, i.e. the jet stream. If you look at the front of a car, Michael, and you see the fan belt moving clockwise around some pulleys, counterclockwise around other pulleys, that's exactly what they can do. And we see incredibly ridiculous jet stream configurations now. And we know the science is clear. We know they're able to do this. And there's another aspect of radio frequency microwave transmissions. It has a repelling effect on these particles. So in the case of hurricane manipulation, and we've recorded this at geoengineeringwatch.org, I hope people research geoengineeringwatch.org hurricanes and look at some of our posts and the recordings. We have, most recently, Hurricane Ian. We recorded the ground-based transmission facilities steering that storm. And we can speculate about the agendas. We can speculate about the objectives. But the fact that that storm was steered is inarguable. We recorded it. The repelling effect of those transmitters tends to push the air mass that's saturated with these electrically conductive particles. It, again, has a repelling or pushing effect. And in that process, they are able to steer these storms. And the recordings we have of this process occurring is shocking. I challenge people to look at it. So that is a key core aspect of climate engineering, the radio frequency microwave transmissions.
Now, if they have this ability, why aren't they using it to fill up the reservoirs?
Well, again, that would only come with the assumption that those in power are here to benefit us. And I would argue, when we have the global elite making clear that there are far too many humans and we need to cull populations as fast as possible, the notion that they are here to help us, I think, needs to be honestly looked at. It is certainly not the case. And how many examples of that do we have? Let's go back to the nuclear bombs. When they detonated the bombs in Nevada, for example, how many Americans know that by peer-reviewed study right now, it is calculated that no less than 500,000 Americans died from the downstream effect of that, eventually, from the contamination from the Nevada detonations? When we have, again, those in power clearly advocating for radical reduction in global populations, the notion that they would do everything they could to make sure the population can continue to proliferate and consume until there's nothing left, that's not part of their agenda. And that should be clear at this point. In regard to the lack of rain in California, I would challenge listeners to search presentations we did nearly a decade ago at geoengineeringwatch.org, Engineered Drought Catastrophe, Target California, a decade ago. And we have presentations going back almost a decade before that. Everything we said would happen has happened. It couldn't not happen with these programs allowed to continue. So we have satellite imagery of these operations off the western U.S. coast breaking up the storm formation process. So we can speculate about agendas and objectives, but the fact that they're stopping rain from coming into the west can't be argued.
Okay, Food Chain Radio, is the weird weather we're having caused by nature or nurture? And when we come back, we're going to find out what exactly has been done to our environment and ourselves with Dane Whittington. Do stay tuned.
We're on the farm with Joel Salatin.
Would you like to buy homemade soup, backyard chicken, and the neighbor's artisanal lunch meat? The Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund protects your right to acquire the food of your choice from the source of your choice. I'm Joel Salatin from Polyface Farm, and I urge you to defend the right of neighbors to engage in direct food commerce. Join today at farmtoconsumer.org, the food of your choice from the source of your choice. That's farmtoconsumer.org, farmtoconsumer.org. Thank you.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
Here's a little secret I'm telling you. Take a little pledge called the 2x2. Spend $2 on local food each day and get two friends to do the same and play. Oh, they'll spend their money, and when they're through, they'll get two friends and do it too. Do da do da 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 do 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 boom boom boom. There's a little secret I shared with you, a simple pledge called the 2x2. You can do it, it don't cost much, it's so easy it'll make you blush. Pledge two local bucks each day, get two others to pledge and play.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Herbal Connections, Maureen Rogers. I rate MetroFarm very high. All of the information is easy to understand and it reads really fast. You will get your money's worth out of MetroFarm. Egg economist, Dr. John Wison.
Olson's MetroFarms enjoy competitive advantages which allow them to produce more crops per unit of higher quality at less cost than large-scale farms.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning Metro Farm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
So much to say. so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, it's kind of hard to believe that somebody could actually go up there and change our sky, our atmosphere, in order to completely engineer how the climate works. But the climate sure is weird these days. And so we look at our reservoirs, we look at our rivers, and we wonder, is this weird weather a result of nature or nurture? Now, I've always looked at it as nature having her way with the world. And if you look at tree rings, you know, we've had droughts that exceed 100 years throughout our history here in California. And yet, you know, you just keep wondering, is somebody doing something to the environment? Is somebody re-engineering our environment? My goodness, they're re-engineering, they're weaponizing bugs now, tiny microscopic bugs. So who knows? Dane Wigington has a very good idea. He is the lead investigator at Geoengineering Watch. He also does a radio show called GeoWatch Radio, in which he lays on the table the things that he sees happening as a consequence of this geoengineering being put forth by them. What exactly are they doing to our environment, Dane?
They're laying waste to it, and that's on top of other forms of human activity, which, again, we absolutely acknowledge fully at Geoengineering Watch. We're going through 100 million barrels of carbon fuel a day. We can't continue with that. And that's a massive problem in and of itself. But again, what we stress and we encourage people to do is investigate, abandon preconception, programming, and ideology. Please look at the data. That's all we're asking. We're non-political. And this intentional intervention in the Earth's climate system has derailed the planet from responding to the damage done. So, and one key point on the droughts that are happening all over the globe, we have drought deluge scenarios. So we have some areas completely underwater, other areas can't get a drop, and that is the hallmark of climate engineering operations. So in regard to the overall drought, though, and there is much more overall drought on the planet than any historical norm based on paleo data going back a very long way, thousands of years. How can that happen on a planet that's warming? And the planet is warming. When we check temperature readings, what we see is a radical underreporting of the actual high temperature, radical underreporting. So that means it's much, much warmer already than we're being told. We know from the laws of physics that the atmosphere contains 7% more moisture for every degree C of warming. It has to rain more overall on a warming planet, much, much more. It's not. The only way it can't is if there's a factor we're not being told about. That factor is climate engineering, and we ask people to look at time-lapse film footage we have at geoengineeringwatch.org. Many, many reels of the whole horizon being covered with aerosol operations that expand and linger and virtually cover the entire skyline. Now, any meteorologist that says that that can't affect the weather is in some other reality. You radically affect the weather when you do that. When you block direct sunlight, especially over the oceans, you affect the evaporative cycle, you reduce evaporation overall, and clearly, again,
Dane, if the Earth is warming and everybody says, well, sure, it's warming, the glaciers are melting, so there is some warming going on. If there is warming, then more water should be being evaporated out of the oceans, and more rain should therefore fall. But that's not what's happening.
Correct.
That's not what you're seeing. What do you see where you live?
In my specific location, since 2007, when we saw the climate engineering operation set up a particular pattern and hold that pattern, we are 500 inches of rain short in my location since 2007. Our normal annual of 70 inches has averaged about 35. We've had some years as low as the teens. But cumulatively, since 2007, we're about 500 inches of rain short here. So again, based on paleo data, nothing like this has happened in the geologic record going back thousands of years. And in regard to the environmental groups, we have great disdain for them at geoengineeringwatch.org, not because they care about the environment, because we do too, but because they are more concerned about protecting their 501 nonprofit than they are telling the whole truth. We know this because our attorneys have spoken to their attorneys from World Wildlife Federation, Greenpeace, Earth Justice, Sierra Club, all of them. And none of them will discuss the climate engineering issue because they don't want to lose their nonprofit status. And that seems to us unbelievably hypocritical.
And your assertion is then that they're getting money from somebody who doesn't want anybody to know that there is such a thing as geoengineering.
Wherever they're getting their money, they have a nonprofit status that is a gift from the government that they don't have to pay taxes, period. We see the spiritual institutions doing exactly the same thing. They won't address this issue. They don't want to lose their nonprofit status. Again, seems to us to be unimaginably hypocritical. So we all just pretend it's not going on to keep the party going while the ship goes down by the day. And it is going down by the day. If I could make mention of how bad it is so people understand that the severity of this issue, we have statistically at this point lost 80 to 90% of global terrestrial insects, 80 to 90%.
Wait a minute. I just drove from all the way up through California's Great Central Valley all the way into Oregon, and I never once had to wash the bugs off my windshield.
Thank you for stating so. Thank you. And we were the first to publish this about 10 plus years ago because of our work with former U.S. Forest Service scientists and fish and game scientists. The science community tried to marginalize us at geoengineeringwatch.org. Now they've admitted to it. I challenge your listeners to search insect apocalypse. We're getting acknowledgement of that. And it's not just the insects. Plankton. We've just gotten, 2 months ago, we got peer-reviewed study on plankton populations in the Atlantic, down 90%. That is a virtual crash. We have media trying to cover it up, governments trying to cover it up. No plankton, no people. That's simple. Plankton produce 50% of Earth's oxygen. It is the basis for food chains all over the planet, and we feel the other oceans are in a similar condition. We have dead zones all over the planet right now. Species extinction rate today. We're losing 200 to 300 species of plant, animal, and insect to extinction every single day. And people who doubt that don't realize how many species there are on their planet, many of which have never been identified. The vast majority have never been identified. So when we talk about very small species in the animal and plant kingdom, so 200 to 300 a day, that's 15,000 times the background rate, 15,000 times normal. That's 1.5% of normal. We are neck deep in the sixth great mass extinction right now. We've lost 70% of Earth's wildlife populations in the last 40 years.
So, Dane, your assertion is that we, the people, are out there messing up the environment. You know, we throw our beer bottles out the windows and do really stupid things. But on top of what we do, they are doing much, much more by inserting various kinds of elements into our environment in such a way that they actually block the sun and reduce the amount of sunshine that's getting through. Are they trying to do this to cool the earth? Is that the reason why they're doing it? Global warming?
That is the stated purpose, to mitigate or slow down the warming of the planet. But not surprisingly, this kind of intervention has far more negative effects. And the feedback mechanisms it triggers, in reality, what they can do is create short-term temporary toxic cooling at the cost of an even worse overall warming. So again, there's no benevolence in these programs whatsoever. And on top of that, these programs are the single greatest ozone-destroying factor of all, by far. Not just the particulate dispersions, which have an oxidizing and ozone-destroying effect in the atmosphere, but also the radio frequency microwave transmissions, all destroying the ozone layer. We have a former NASA contract engineer that works directly for us, and he is metering with state-of-the-art equipment for us. We're getting UVC in the surface. That's a DNA-damaging spectrum of UV radiation. It is the last spectrum of UV before we hit X-ray. I think we all know how harmful that is. And we have what amounts to functional ozone layer collapse as close as 24 months. If that happens, you won't be able to grow anything. Plankton are being wiped out from the intense UV radiation. Plankton have to feed in the upper layers of the water column, and the UV radiation is frying them. So again, when we trigger this downstream cascading cataclysm of negative effects from this intervention, this toxic intervention, It is a death sentence for the planet and for us.
It's always the canaries in the mine that we see being troubled first.
Yes.
But what about us? Is this having an impact on our bodies, on our physical well-being?
Certainly. Let's look at the declining IQs in the continental U.S. I believe it's calculated now 6 to 9 points of IQ decline in the last several decades. That's inconceivable. And yes, we have programming and media and all sorts of other things affecting that, but cognitively speaking, that's a physiological effect. When we're inhaling, and we are, aluminum particles, along with barium, strontium, manganese, graphene, that has very well documented neurological effects, and the cognitive decline is staggering. Diseases that are all linked to these metals are going off the charts. Alzheimer's, dementia, ALS, and that's the tip of the iceberg. And our hair, blood, urine test, everybody that is tested is off the charts with these metals, starting with aluminum. And we have a so-called medical community that won't acknowledge us. In fact, we have people from some recent patients in Kaiser Permanente tried to get aluminum testing done. Big flashing screen. Not validated. Or they refuse to test for these metals. The system is completely rigged because their funding is coming from up the ladder. And the system and the physicians in it are encouraged not to test for these types of metals.
Yeah, and there's one more thing you made mention of in the dimming, and that is the use of nanoparticles and the impact of nanoparticles on our bodies, because there's nothing to stop them from going right straight through us.
Thank you for bringing that up. That is hugely important. Let's put this into mathematical terms. So people hear about air quality testing, they generally test for PM10, 10 microns. Some PM2.5 testing, and we hear a lot of data now about how harmful the PM2.5 is because it's smaller. Now let's look at nanoparticles. You could fit 60,000 across the width of the human hair. They're inconceivably small, and because they're so small, they infiltrate every aspect of the web of life. When we inhale them, they go straight through our lung lining, straight into our bloodstream, across the blood-brain barrier. You can't stop them. And our atmosphere is saturated with them. Nanoparticles are the primary element named in climate engineering patents. And how many nanoparticles are they putting in our sky? We have a globally recognized testing institution that we are not disclosing yet because they want to avoid the blowback. But we have quantified with 100 rain samples the amount of material in those samples and extrapolated what the global dispersion would be if it's uniform to that state. They did an entire U.S. state. 60 to 70 million tons, 60 to 70 million tons of nanoparticles being sprayed into our skies annually.
All to control the environment and all to control the population of the Earth. And it always seems to be an issue of control. And as Lyndon Johnson so eloquently said, whoever controls the weather controls everything. And that's pretty much the way it is. Do they have control, or are they tweaking with trying to get control?
That's another really, really important question. And at this point, because they're playing with systems that are so unimaginably complex, I would argue they have a tiger by the tail at this point, that they are playing weather whack-a-mole with toxic elements. The system is blowing apart. We've triggered feedback mechanisms, and let me name one that's primary because this is very key. It could hold all of our futures in the balance. Methane feedback, and I'm not talking about cow flatulence. Now, livestock's a problem when you cut down forests to raise livestock. That's a problem, not denying that. But we have formerly frozen methane hydrate and clathrate fields that are exploding into the atmosphere, literally exploding. Your listeners can search Siberian methane craters and look at the images of those craters in Siberian tundra. They look like a nuclear bomb went off, and that's methane.
They're kind of like giant earth farts.
In a sense, that's a fair analogy. And so we have that happening on the seafloor on a scale 10 times bigger than anything we see on land. Methane over a 10-year time horizon is 100 to 120 times more potent than CO2 as a greenhouse gas. It's like covering the planet with a layer of glass. Heat gets in, doesn't get out. Climate engineering making it worse, not better.
Okay, Dane, we have just a minute left. What the heck can we do?
what we do is reach a critical mass of awareness. We cannot fight this battle without an army of the awakened. At geoengineeringwatch.org, we provide printed activist materials at less than our cost to try to get them into circulation. They're on the homepage of geoengineeringwatch.org. And those materials or links from our website, which are, of course, all free, can be shared with people. Share credible data from a credible source. That's how you wake people up. You don't point at the sky and rant and say they're trying to kill us all, even if they are. So you share credible science data, and that's how you gain traction. If we can bring this issue to light, we have a chance of stopping it from the inside out by making those who are participating and their families aware of the fact they are participating in their own common demise. That's how we stop it.
Well, Dane Wigington from Geoengineering Watch, thank you so much for joining us today. I would encourage people to visit geoengineeringwatch.org, watch the dimming, and make up your own mind. What do you think? Is this real or what? I have traditionally been a nature kind of guy. I think that climate's, is an incredibly complicated piece of business, our climate. I once did a term paper to define utopia. I went and got a picture of the Earth and I pasted it on a black piece of paper and I said, a utopia. And it's such a beautiful place that we live. And we just hope that we can do what we can do to keep it going. Dane Wigington, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you all for tuning in.
Thank you, Michael.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.